B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, October 18th, 2018. Back in 1989 on this fateful day, I was at Candlestick Park waiting for the World Series game to get underway when the fateful Loma Prieta earthquake hit. One of those never-forget moments. Today, we begin our news and comment podcast with tales of two whistleblowers, one freshly surfaced, one who is about to be sentenced. We begin with the case of Natalie Mayflower Sewers Edwards, who is a senior advisor in the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. The story broke yesterday, and we shared it with you, that she leaked thousands, it appears, of documents called suspicious activity reports and other official reports from her agency, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, to Jason Leopold of BuzzFeed News. My listeners know Jason well. He's been contributing to this podcast and to my radio shows before that. I've known him since, I think I met him first in about 2003, 15 years. And this is the kind of work that Jason excels at. As you know, he is one of the foremost users of the Freedom of Information Act, and that has led people to trust him with official government documents. And so he has built his journalistic craft on acquiring official documents. And some of you know that I had a little dust-up with Jason, almost a year now, because I challenged some of his reporting based on anonymous sources and leaked documents that we were not permitted to see. And so there are times when I take exception or I simply don't find persuasive some of the work that Jason has been doing since he joined BuzzFeed, because it's not all based on documents that we can see. Now, in this case, we now know the source of many of the documents that fueled articles that Leopold published over the past year, at least a dozen of them. And it does answer a question for me, because I believed that he was getting these documents leaked from someone related to the Mueller special counsel team at the Justice Department. And at least in the case of these financial documents, these suspicious activity reports related to Paul Manafort, his old buddy Rick Gates, also Maria Butina, the alleged Russian spy. It appears all those came from this woman, Edwards, at the Treasury Department. And I have linked to a story because the left-wing or, you know, mainstream corporate media isn't really giving a fair amount of attention to this today. I found a pretty good report from a Trump-supporting website called redstate.com. And I don't have a byline here to give credit to, but it is a well-written article that is, critical. It posts a tweet from our friend Yasha Levine, where he said, "Jason Leopold really shines as a naked conduit for anonymous national security leaks." That was a tweet from just about a year ago, November of 2017, that Levine put up. And it did get noticed that Leopold was being fed a lot of documents related to the Russia investigation. And as I said, I inaccurately inferred or deduced that those leaks were coming from people tied to the Mueller investigation. So this is, I think, informative to learn this. And from the indictment of Edwards, the charging document, we learn that she initially lied to investigators, and then she admitted that she had sent thousands of these documents to a person identified in the charging papers as Journalist One, Reporter One. And we know now that that is Jason Leopold, based on the nature of the articles that she has admitted leaking information for. So Ms. Edwards is age 40. Her LinkedIn profile says that she is a Native American whose family was from Virginia before before the white men arrived. She is charged with one count of unauthorized disclosure of suspicious activity reports and one count of conspiracy to make unauthorized disclosures. Now, this raises a number of questions just on the face of it. If she leaked thousands of documents, why is she only being charged with one count of disclosure and one count of conspiracy? Well, the conspiracy charge suggests that there is somebody else involved. And that excludes the reporters who are mentioned in the indictment. And what you learn if you read carefully in the charging documents is that someone else in Edwards' department also leaked hundreds of documents to Reporter One, and that this person appears to be a superior of Ms. Edwards at the Treasury Department's financial, whatever that department is called. So this suggests that Ms. Edwards copped a pretty quick plea deal where she agreed to plead to one count of this and one count of that, and presumably she will be testifying against her colleague, who is described as an associate director of the FinCEN department, to whom Ms. Edwards reports. So if you connect these dots, it indicates that metadata was used. They describe a judicially authorized pen register trap and trace order, and that coughs up the time of a call, the originating number, and the number it connected to. And the documents tell us that encrypted text messaging platforms were used, most likely WhatsApp. And even though the messages themselves were encrypted, the authorities were able, through the court order, to get the metadata and to determine the number of attachments to each text message. So, for example, between on or about August 24, 2018 and October 2, 2018, the cell phone of this higher up exchanged approximately 301 messages with Reporter One's cell phone. And they allege that there was back and forth between Edwards and this unnamed superior, and that the superior directly sent messages to Leopold's cell phone as well. So I find this fascinating. And I'd love to get Jason Leopold on the program right now, but I feel like he is radioactive. And if I call him or text him or email him, would it bring unwanted attention to yours truly? And this is the kind of chilling effect that the public disclosure of these arrangements between a leaker and a reporter will undoubtedly have. So I think this is going to be a fascinating case to watch. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm not aware that Jason Leopold has broken a single law. It is not a crime to receive leaked materials. It may be a crime for the person who originates the leak. And that will probably be tested in a court case down the road. Although the higher-up individual at FinCEN may plead guilty and there may never be a trial to air all of this out. We shall see. The other tale of the whistleblower that I want to share with you today is another person who appears to have been burned by leaking to The Intercept. His name is Terry Albury. He grew up here in Northern California, went to work for the FBI after 9/11, transferred to their Minneapolis office, and after he blew the whistle on activities that he found to be inappropriate for the FBI, they fired him. And last April, Terry Albury, a 17-year veteran of the FBI, the only black agent in the Minneapolis field office, pled guilty to two federal charges of violating the Espionage Act after he was accused of taking dozens of FBI documents, including several that were classified, and leaking some to the press. And this is where The Intercept gets really dodgy, just like they did with Reality Winner. They won't cop to their own failings. They won't acknowledge that they burned Reality Winner when one of their editors or reporters went to the government with the document she leaked and said, "Is this a real document?" And in this case, it's a little murky. The Intercept reports about itself. Court documents filed against Albury did not identify the news outlet he was accused of leaking to, but reports linked the charges to a series of stories published by The Intercept regarding secret guidelines for the FBI's use of informants, surveillance of journalists, and other topics. I recall reading stories like that at The Intercept, and I just believe that they should be more honest with their readers, and they've got to be more honest with their leakers. Because when you look at the number of people who have been burned by The Intercept, it's a very clear signal. If you're going to leak, don't do it there. So, as he faces sentencing, Albury's attorneys are making the case that he was driven to his actions by the racism he witnessed throughout his career at the FBI, both within the agency and in the ways in which the Bureau interacted with communities it policed, particularly when he was told to conduct surveillance of the Somali-American community near Minneapolis. His attorneys argue his objective in disclosure was to alert the U.S. public to practices and procedures he believed represented both a systemic departure from the FBI's proper mission in counterterrorism and abuses of the enormous investigative authority the FBI has been granted since 9/11, you know, like national security letters. So Albury, to me, is an honorable whistleblower. The lawyers went on to say, worse yet, Terry was required to implement FBI investigative directives that sanctioned the use of race and religion as basis for targeting wide swaths of communities throughout Minnesota. Now, the government says that over 18 months, Albury stole information from more than 70 documents, including 50 classified documents, taking photographs, copying and pasting them, and they found a cache of documents that he wasn't supposed to take home in a pocket of a jacket in his clothes closet. So I find this an interesting case. As you know, I'm sympathetic to whistleblowers. You can probably pick up my bias about that. And I believe that the FBI does operate in a racist manner in the way it has used paid informants to infiltrate Muslim communities across America, and that Terry Albury is trying to blow the whistle on that. But for the most part, he will be ignored, and he likely faces at least 5 years in federal prison. Yesterday, I noted that the corporate media has not been really very upset by Facebook's purging of nearly 800 pages and accounts of independent media outlets, many on the left, which occurred a week ago today. One of the exceptions is at BuzzFeed today, where not a staff person, but an independent, an outsider, was permitted to publish an op-ed, an opinion piece. And the man's name is Mark Belial. And he says that he used to work at Reverb Press, one of the pages that was targeted and taken down last week. And he takes Facebook to task in a very intelligent way. I've linked to this article so you can read it at your leisure. Now, he says, to begin with, Reverb was given no warning, no chance to make things right. It learned it was being purged at the same time everyone else did. His former colleague, the managing editor, James Reeder, told him that long before the closure, Reeder had been trying to communicate with Facebook to make sure the page was following its best practices, but he could never get hold of anyone. And this is a problem everybody faces. You can't call Facebook. You can't call Twitter. I tried once. The only number that Twitter publishes is a human resources number. But you can't get Jack Dorsey on the phone or anybody else who works there. I was trying to reach a guy who was in advertising sales. You would think they want those people to be available and accessible. But these internet companies are just completely faceless. You cannot get anybody to engage with you. He also points out that the purged pages were accused of spam because they were mixing their political messaging content, some of it with opinion, some of it just fact, with advertising. And I will admit that Free Thought Project and some of these others, I avoided those websites not because I didn't find them credible all the time, but because they put ads everywhere. I mean, every third sentence was interrupted by another ad. But That's the only way they have of generating revenue. And in this piece, the former Reverb writer says, but you know who always got paid? Facebook. Reverb Press paid Facebook tens of thousands of dollars over 4 years, ad dollars needed just to reach our audience. Facebook made a lot more money off my work than I ever did. He goes on to say that it's so hypocritical that Facebook's accusation that the Reverb page was motivated by money. Facebook has a virtual monopoly over social media, rakes in tens of billions of dollars a year in revenue that it collects from selling out its users to advertising companies. It squeezes small businesses and publications, pushing them to pay for the privilege of reaching even a fraction of the people who follow their pages. It produces virtually no content, but generates a gargantuan profit from other people's work. And it is apparently deeply concerned about publishers that are motivated by money. Well, he really nails them in this piece, Mark Belisle, and I encourage you to read it. I will just echo that I don't pay Facebook to boost my posts anymore. And as you know, every day when I post a podcast, there is a Facebook post that comes out of my WordPress system. Facebook serves that to maybe a dozen people. On a good day, it might be 50. And I have thousands of friends and followers, many of whom indicate that they want to receive all of my posts. But the algorithm doesn't feature the Peter B. Collins podcast the way I believe it should. And so I just put up with whatever Facebook decides to do on a given day. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. Great people, like he said, turning the page to freshen up the list, Brian Mazzi, Benny Alto, Arlene Montemarano, and Aiden McAleer. They're great listeners who kick in $5 or $10 a month, and I invite you to do the same. Because of the whole crackdown, the fake news crackdown that has limited search engines from directing people to my podcast, limited my distribution of posts on Facebook, I have to rely on you to support my work, both in terms of evangelism. I really appreciate Ford Green and Jason Spitzer put up yesterday's podcast on Facebook, and it gets far more traffic there than when I do it myself. That kind of support is really helpful. So if you'd like to become a subscriber, just visit peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You're on the sign-up page, and you can choose the level of support most comfortable for you. Well, as I sat down to record the podcast today, I saw a breaking news report that Donald Trump has finally conceded that Jamal Khashoggi is probably dead. And that means that the ruse that Trump has been trying to use to claim, well, he just disappeared, he went in, he didn't come out, the Saudis say they didn't snuff him, so what am I going to do? Well, he's certainly caught in a bind. And his Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin went to the White House today, and Mike Pompeo, who just jet-lagged in from Istanbul, was there. The three of them met and decided that Mnuchin will not go to the Davos in the desert, this trade fair that was set up by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and many people have defected from that. But Turkey keeps releasing more information. Today, it's surveillance camera images of people approaching the Saudi consulate, and they identify Maher Mutreb, who is the chief of the security detail for Crown Prince MBS. They also, according to The Guardian here, they can identify 12 of the 15 members of the Saudi kill squad who descended in two corporate jets into Istanbul on, I believe it's October 2nd, when the incident occurred. So while, you know, we don't have the actual evidence, we don't have the audio recordings we're told exist, and I heard Rush Limbaugh this morning before the Trumpster tipped that he thinks Khashoggi is dead, trying to defend this by spinning this big yarn about how the Apple Watch works, and gosh, you know, it's too far for Bluetooth, and it couldn't have been Wi-Fi because they would have had to have the secret password of the Saudi consulate. But there are many ways that Turkey could acquire this audio, and it's possible that they have every consulate and embassy in their country wired. And that's where they got this audio. So the Apple Watch story does not have to be operative and provable to believe that the Turks have an audio recording. And the level of detail, including the chilling claim that the coroner expert, the forensic expert who flew in with the bone saw, his name is Dr. Salah Al-Tubaigi. It really is not possible to reject this. And as you know, I'm the guy who is skeptical of mainstream media narratives and conspiracy theories driven by national governments. But in this case, I have to say that the circumstantial evidence is extremely persuasive. And the New York Times has been following the ebb and flow of leaks from Turkey. And they basically say when Turkey sees Trump protecting the Saudis, they leak more information, trying to make it impossible for him to hold on to that position. So Mnuchin's not going to the Davos in the desert. That's just fine. And here I have some comments that were published today. And first, I have the column that was what we now know is the final column that the Washington Post will print under the byline of Jamal Khashoggi. And I want to underscore, as I did yesterday, Khashoggi was not an American journalist. If he could claim to be a journalist, it's when he worked in Saudi Arabia, which doesn't have any journalism. He was an opinion writer. He was not a staff person at the Washington Post. And the descriptions of him are, as I pointed out yesterday, very careless and really don't accurately describe his connection to the paper. Anyway, his final column makes a plea for freedom of expression in the Arab world. And, it's hard to argue with, but people who speak Arabic and English, who have read Khashoggi's columns that were published in the Middle East in Arabic in the past year, say that those were very different in tone, very deferential to the monarchies, and not the kind of shit disturber that we are seeing him made out to be in the U.S. media. So I've linked to the Khashoggi column, and you can read it. One of the things he calls for: the Arab world is facing its own version of an iron curtain, he says, imposed not by external actors, but through domestic forces vying for power. During the Cold War, Radio Free Europe, which grew over the years into a critical institution, played an important role in fostering and sustaining the hope of freedom. Arabs need something similar. Well, Jamal, didn't you ever hear about Al-Hura, the U.S. propaganda operation aimed at the Middle East in Arabic? I believe it is still on the air. Also today, the Washington Post published a fascinating story about a man named Omar Abdulaziz. He is a Saudi national in self-imposed exile in Montreal, Canada. And he recorded incidents that he shared the recordings of with reporters for the Washington Post, where he says emissaries from Mohammed bin Salman came to Montreal to try to pressure him, first with seduction and then with threats, to return to Saudi Arabia. Now, Abdulaziz went to school in Canada, and during the Arab Spring, he says he developed a Twitter and YouTube following. He routinely criticizes the royal regime there in Saudi Arabia. And this story parallels what he says happened to his friend Khashoggi. He and Khashoggi were working on some schemes or projects to amplify the voices of individual Saudis and challenge the regime, according to him. Khashoggi sent him $5,000 for a project they called the Bees, intending to build an online army inside Saudi Arabia to challenge the pro-government trolls on the Internet. So clearly they were friends. And when these emissaries came and tried to pressure Abdulaziz into returning, he resisted, and Khashoggi had advised him to do the same. And so it's an interesting look at the way Mohammed bin Salman has been working to silence critics of his royal monarchic government, critics all over the world, critics who may not have had that much impact on his ability to rule with an iron fist. But it appears he could tolerate zero dissent and was trying to snuff it out wherever he could. A couple of quick quotes from the official commentators at the New York Times. Brett Stevens, who, as I pointed out last week, used to be the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, wrote a column where he doesn't mention how important Saudi Arabia is to Israel and its maneuvering to run America's foreign policy. But one comment he made really bugs me. He said, Khashoggi was not Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born radical cleric killed in 2011 on orders from Obama after he had joined forces with an al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen and gone to war with the United States. So he is rationalizing the American drone strike that took out an American citizen without due process. He says that's okay. But the murder of Khashoggi isn't a blunder, it's a crime, and he gets on his high horse about that. Then Tom Friedman, who presents himself as the most knowledgeable American about the Middle East, well, he talks about Jamal as if he were a saint, a teddy bear of a man, he calls him. But he tries to argue, and he admits the weakness of his own argument. I don't need to totally slam Friedman here today. But he raises important issues that after 9/11, the projection of Salafi Islam and Wahhabi Islam by the rich rulers of Saudi Arabia is what has heated up jihadi activity around the world. They are the direct source. They're the paternity for most of the jihadi actions that have occurred over the last 15 years. So he has a logical point that dealing with the Saudi fundamentalist projection of Islam is an important goal. And he acknowledges that he may have been seduced, like others, into believing that by letting women drive and letting people go to concerts and watch movies, that Mohammed bin Salman was really reforming the nation of Saudi Arabia. And he says, for starters, I believe the promise of MBS, however much you did or did not think he could bring social, economic, and religious reform, is finished. He's made himself radioactive. Absent a credible independent exoneration for Jamal's disappearance and apparent murder, MBS may be able to hold on to power in Saudi Arabia, but his whole reform program is dead. The last few words were mine, not his. Anyway, it's an interesting read. But frankly, the kind of rationalizations to believe that you can punish Saudi Arabia for this public murder while maintaining relationships that could advance the modernization of life in Saudi Arabia, I just think that's irrational. I don't think it's possible. And the only thing they will understand is if we adopt a standard of human rights. And that's not going to happen under Trump. And that's why I believe that all of the Sturm und Drang about this is just empty rhetoric. Yesterday, in one of the most devastating assassination strikes of the Afghan war, Taliban insiders killed top leaders in Kandahar province. They killed the powerful police chief, the provincial intelligence chief. They wounded the governor. And it was a near miss for the top American commander in the country, General Austin Miller. And I'll point out that my nephew Liam is serving in Army intelligence in Kandahar right now. And there were three Americans wounded. I just hope he wasn't one of them. Carol Rosenberg has given excellent coverage for the Miami Herald of the Guantanamo Gulag. And I was puzzled by, you know, she didn't get to write this headline, but the story yesterday reads, "Two Guantanamo detainees refused to leave. Now they're stuck there, Commander says." And the "Commander says" part is important because he kind of flippantly said, "Well, look, you know, two of them had an opportunity to get on an airplane and chose not to go. So how bad could it be here?" Well, Rosenberg retorts gently that the men in question have serious mental health issues. Two of them have been there since the very early days of the prison opening in early 2002. And who knows what the methylquinone did to their mental health and, you know, what years of incarceration without charge or trial can do. But there are actually five people who are stuck at Guantanamo today, who were cleared for release by the Obama administration. In some cases, they rejected the third nations where they were going to be sent because they had no idea what kind of reception they would get. And so it's tragic because the Trump administration shut down the resettlement operations, and these guys are stuck there for what could be an eternity. And that's probably what it feels like for Julian Assange. Recently, The Guardian reported that he and his allies tried to gin up a scheme where he would be transferred to Russia last year around Christmas time. And Assange and those allies denied it all. Now, The Guardian is reporting that Ecuadorian government documents that were released by an opponent of the plan to continue to provide asylum for Assange indicate that there was a plan to make Assange a diplomat. They were naming him a political counselor, and they were going to post him to the Ecuadorian embassy in Moscow and pay him $2,000 a month. So the files indicate that the plan was canceled because the British government didn't consider Assange to be an acceptable member of a diplomatic mission. They essentially vetoed that. And then Ecuador withdrew their designation him of as a diplomat. Yesterday we told you about Trump. There's this new caravan moving north, started in Honduras, moved through Guatemala, heading for the Mexican border. Now we are told it's grown to as many as 4,000 people. And this scares the shit out of Trump. I don't know why. The last caravan fizzled and, you know, maybe a few dozen members of a 2,000 contingent got into the United States. But his panties are all twisted up. "I must, in the strongest of terms, ask Mexico to stop this onslaught. And if unable to do so, I will call up the U.S. military and," all caps, "close our southern border." So he's looking for an Alamo incident. He wants to make a big stand. And he claims that there are criminals in the caravan. No evidence has emerged of criminal affiliations among the members of the caravan, who mostly told reporters they're fleeing gang violence and poverty. They're traveling as a group in order to protect themselves from criminals. And finally today, the Democrats in the Senate made a deal with the Republicans, and they got screwed again. Last week, Chuck Schumer said, "Hey, we'll just agree to confirm these 15 conservative judges if you recess the Senate so our senators can go campaign for re-election." And Mitch McConnell said okay. And then Chuck Grassley over at the Judiciary Committee just started holding hearings to move the process along of confirming some of the most problematic appointees that Trump has dredged up, including Alison Rushing, a 36-year-old social conservative who has been part of the legal team at the Federalist Society. She also participated in the case from the baker from Colorado who didn't want to bake the wedding cake for the gay couple. So what else has happened here is that the Democrats who thought they could trust the Republicans have seen routinely where the longstanding process in the Senate, where if a judicial nominee does not have the approval of at least one of his or her home state senators, that nomination will not go forward. And just last week, one of the 15 that Schumer agreed to confirm was a judge from California or a candidate from California who had not received approval from either Senator Feinstein or Senator Harris. And so the bulldozing of these traditions and the prerogatives of American senators has been blown up in favor of raw political power. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. I hope you will. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.